Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The inner and outer workings of Congress have always intrigued me. I like to watch and talk about the process with those involved and with other observers. This week on Radio Curious, my guest will be my old law school friend, Sam Farr, a member of the United States House of Representatives, whose district includes Monterey and Santa Cruz counties. In this interview, we'll discuss the USA Patriot Act, the Freedom to Read Act of 2003, and the influence that the Democrats, the minority party, have in both houses of Congress. When Sam Farr and I spoke on the phone a few weeks ago prior to recording this program, he talked about the political significance of the Democrats not having access to the microphone for the first time in 50 years. In this conversation, I asked him to start with that topic.
Well, Barry, right now it's the first time in 50 years that the microphone of the president of the Senate and of the Speaker of the House is all in Republican control. There are no checks and balances in Washington. The Democratic Party has been relegated to a minority party. It is treated by the press as such. They sort of ignore Democrats, and that's why you hear people saying, well, where's the Democratic Party? We don't hear from you. We don't see you. Well, the press knows that we couldn't get a room scheduled in the Capitol without the consent of the Republicans.
The Democrats can't get a room scheduled in the Capitol without the consent of the Republicans. What does that mean on a rules level? Or who's in charge?
The Republican leadership's in charge, and they decide what bills will be heard. They will decide what witnesses will be called. They'll decide what questions will be asked. They'll decide when a vote is going to be taken in committee to pass a bill out, or because we don't take bills, we don't take votes on any bill if it's going to die. They decide the entire agenda of what we're going to hear, who we're going to ask questions of, and when votes will be scheduled on the floor and whether or not any amendments can be made to those votes.
Do they limit Democratic representatives who are on any given committee from asking certain questions? Do they tell you you can't ask?
No. That's why there's still a freedom of expression. But the committees are stacked so that even if you have it's not a 50-50 split or 51-49 split, it's more like a 60-40 split. Even though that's not where the House of Representatives stands in the nation, it's a much closer number between the Democrats and Republicans. And there's just not a fair split on committees.
It's the Republican leadership that assigns the committee seats.
That's correct. They give the number to the Democrats, which is far less than the committee members the Republicans have, and say you can appoint so many members each committee.
So, in other words, Republican members can be on multiple committees and Democratic members are only on one or two?
That's correct. I sit on the Appropriations Committee, and the Democrats are limited to two committees, and the Republicans, most of them, sit on three subcommittees.
How about in the Senate? How does it work there?
Well, it's much different. The Senate is a unique body. There's nothing like it anywhere in the legislative annals of the state. The Senate is a membership of 100 people. It has no rules, so each person has the ability to do whatever they want to when they are recognized, and they have the microphone, and they can bring up a bill, they can amend a bill, they can adjourn the House, they can do anything. So there's essentially much more of a camaraderie in the Senate to get along. There's also an ability for senators to phone in a system of holding bills from going to the floor. Each senator can block legislation from even getting considered. And so I think they respect each other's powers there and try to work out a more amicable system of allowing a fresh debate.
So in other words, a Democratic senator could block a Republican bill that the Democrat doesn't like?
They could not by themselves, because they could be overruled by the majority of the Senate.
Well, it seems now that the way the Republicans are controlling the House of Representatives and to some extent the Senate is much different than how the Democrats controlled it when they were in power under Clinton.
The House is certainly in Democratic control. The House has been in Democratic control for a long time, and I'm sure we abused our majority, but from what people have told me, not as much as the Republicans are doing now. It's sort of get even and get, you know, don't get mad, get even and get and really get even. I don't know if you read the New Yorker piece on Karl Rove, but it's clear in that piece that the political strategists working for this administration, by all intent and purposes, want to eliminate the Democratic Party from ever being able to have control of either the White House, the Senate, or the House of Representatives. They're doing that through reapportionment at the state level. They're doing that through trying to defeat incumbent candidates, and just to make sure that anybody who's who thinks they can put back a Democratic majority anywhere is not going to be able to make it.
Do you feel that those Republican strategists represent special interests, or do they have another agenda?
Well, I think in not a particular special interest in the sense of an oil company or an insurance company, but certainly an interest to have the Republicans in the majority, and then they tend to favor the interests of business over the interests of, you know, working people. And in that sense, sort of a special interest to give business free range. This is a town, and Newt Gingrich made it a town, where the partisanship really is done with rancor. It's really gotten to a point where the Republicans don't need to talk to the Democrats because they have the majority and they can go about their way, and they are. And so it's getting tougher and tougher in this town to sort of get a fair, open debate anymore.
How would you change the system based on your experience being in Congress for 10 years and being in the state legislature for many years before that?
That's an interesting question, because one of the things I'd like to do, I think it would shock the system, but to have every bill that's referred to a committee heard. It'll bring in witnesses and tell the members of the committee, we're going to work and we're going to vote, just like they do in the state legislature. I mean, you hear, and when I was in California State Legislature, literally thousands of bills in all the committees in a year. You know, Congress only passes probably 200 bills, maybe 300 bills, and most of those are motherhood issues, naming post offices after dead congressmen and so on. It's not a body that puts out a lot of legislation. And so, therefore, I think we would have the time in committees to hear a lot, and that would make us more accountable on the issues. But this is a town that tries to avoid you having to vote on anything that's controversial.
I'd like to take a moment and say that this week we're talking with Congressman Sam Farr, who represents the Santa Cruz and Monterey County areas of the Central Coast of California. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Sam, it sounds like there's a philosophical change that has occurred among the government and the elected officials, or at least the majority of the elected officials in Washington, since Bush took over. And again, 6 months ago, in November of 1992, when the Republicans gained control of the Senate.
There's a radical change in Washington, and make no doubt about it, people back here feel it, sense it, and say they've never seen this much of a shift in history. And it really is boistered by the events of 9/11, which gave the president not only incredible popularity, but a time of uncertainty to move legislation very rapidly to give the administration not only unprecedented authority, but an unprecedented amount of money to spend on homeland defense and homeland security. And in that came the adoption of the so-called Patriot Act, so-called Homeland Security Act, and others. And Homeland Security was a major reorganization of the federal government. It essentially put 172,000 federal employees under one agency. We don't even have a building to hold them. And moved, radically moved people out of the Department of Agriculture, out of, split up INS into two different agencies, moved the Coast Guard into Homeland Security, and so on. Still, people are still reeling from that change back here. And the president, with his popularity, is just moving ahead to you know, a push for privatization of Medicare and privatization of Social Security. I think very soon you will see voucher systems proposed in the public schools in this country, led by incentives given by the federal government. The votes on prayer in school, and today the burning, we passed a constitutional amendment today in the House of Representatives to essentially to punish you for desecrating the flag. I mean, this gives it a higher authority, or maybe allows Congress to usurp the First Amendment rights of freedom of speech. So these are some really shocking things that are happening back here.
Do you feel that the Homeland Security legislation and the Department of Homeland Security actually makes the United States more secure and protected from terrorists?
Absolutely not. I think that it was a gross over-expenditure of money, just throwing it at the problem. I think we could have done a lot without a huge reorganization. What I really needed was the president to appoint leaders within each agency and then have an executive roundtable of those leaders meeting, coming together, and point out how each of the agencies could participate in the sum total of the problem.
What are some of the areas of Homeland Security that are not being addressed?
Well, I've said that you don't have homeland security until you have community security or inner city security. I mean, I've grown up and you've grown up, and we all know communities, in fact our own, where people still feel free to leave their doors unlocked. But if you go into any inner city in America, that's the last thing they would think would be possible. I've told the secretary that I don't think homeland security works until you can trust every neighborhood to be free and safe. And as long as children are intimidated going to school, and there's violence in schools, and there's drive-by shootings, and there's inner-city problems, you're not dealing with Homeland Security if you're not dealing with those issues. And frankly, the bill doesn't address those issues.
Well, what was...
It's more to protect people with money and property of private property.
What was the... Secretary Ridge, the Secretary of Homeland Security, what was his response to your comment?
Well, he didn't have a response because they just don't answer those questions.
How do they get away with not answering them? They just turn around and walk?
No, they don't. Just go on to the next question. We're the party of minority. They don't have to listen to us. We have no authority to yank their salary or to condition them. We certainly can make that threat, but if it goes to a vote, we lose.
How does that play out in terms of the Sunday morning television interview shows where representatives of the executive and leaders of Congress attend, like Meet the Press and so forth, when they're asked the tough questions?
Well, I think that there's a lot of pressure on those talk show hosts. First of all, they have to get permission from the White House to have the Republican leadership show up. Then if they beat up on them, they're going to be told, hey, you can't get access to these people anymore. So they're always, having to be careful about not upsetting the apple cart, because they might not get the right talking head or may not be cut off from access to information. And, you know, with Fox News sort of taking over the conservative role, and having a biased press out there that's only doing one side of the issue, you can see, and being a very popular station, being kind of an alarmist media group, what happens. And if that's the other networks are kind of worried about the competition from Fox.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, since on June 2nd, the Federal Communications Commission voted 3-2 to change some of the rules of the FCC, in particular with regard to station ownership.
Well, first of all, that vote came down right on partisan terms. President Bush's appointees, which is the majority, the three, voted one way, and the Democratic appointees, the holdovers from the Clinton administration, voted the other way. And the minority in this case were very, very critical. In fact, did an unusual thing of going to the press and saying how sort of what a radical change this was by allowing this consolidation of the media in America. My own district, we have Clear Channel, which owns six and has control of another seven radio stations, now owning two out of the three local local broadcast television stations. So they go to their. Why does that get dangerous? It gets dangerous because they can go to their to the people who buy the advertising, which essentially runs the station, and offer them packages that their competitors can't offer. And little by little, you're forcing your competition out of the market. And that's what I think is very, very dangerous. You also have consolidation of that market, and they can begin to interject editorial opinions, which then become the dominant news of the region.
What can the average citizen do about it who feels that that's not the appropriate way to exercise freedom of the press or obtain information?
Well, that gets to the very basic point, which I think is we need to revisit in this country, is that democracy only works with a participatory electorate. And so often the electorate, I think, has been able to be relatively satisfied that the government's taking care of their needs. And things they objected to, they could usually find a outlet in Congress to get that opinion expressed, in many cases get the political powers to stop evil.
But that's not happening now.
That's not happening now, and I think that the difficulty is that people have sort of forgotten that democracy is an old-fashioned institution, and you sort of go back the old-fashioned ways. It isn't easy.
Then how can the average...
Politics isn't a spectator sport.
How can the average citizen participate effectively?
By writing letters to the editor, by petitioning their federal, state, and local representatives and presidents and governors, and most importantly, is by voting and getting people who are their neighbors and their family and their friends to participate in that voting with them.
And they
ought to be shocked about the way this government is moving, and certainly can express their dissatisfaction in the voting booth.
Using the Patriot Act as an example, do you feel it's significant when local communities, cities, or counties adopt a statement in opposition to the Patriot Act?
Well, it's a sense of sort of what we call a sense of Congress or a sense of a city council or board of supervisors. It has no...
It has no effect in Washington legally, but do you think it has an effect socially or politically?
Yes, because those elected officials, and people criticize them for why should you be involved in business that's beyond your jurisdiction. Well, they're elected, and they're elected to reflect a public opinion, not just on zoning issues and so on, but on how they feel the decisions in Sacramento, the decisions in Washington, affect their community. So I think it's perfectly legitimate for them to adopt those positions. Santa Cruz was the town I represent, was the first community in the United States to oppose the war in Iraq. By the time it had finished, both New York and Chicago had joined Santa Cruz. Yes, I think it's entirely appropriate, but I don't think you can stop it there. I think that you can get satisfaction out of that our elected officials here have expressed their opinion.
How far should it extend? When you say you don't think it should stop there,
well, I think it extends to getting petitioning and getting involved in sort of eye to eye. What I think is necessary in America is eye to eye contact with the elected officials.
But how does that happen? You spend the mid part of your week in your situation, for example, you spend the mid part of your week in Washington, D.C. and travel cross country twice, need some downtime. How much eye-to-eye contact do you have with your constituents?
Well, relatively every 5 weeks in Congress, you're home for a week. So the next break will be 4th of July for a whole week. And after that, it'll be the entire month of August for summer break. And members, as you said, do come home. This Friday, we're not voting on Friday, so we're out of here Thursday night. Members will be back in their districts on Fridays, and a lot of them will schedule not only constituent hours, but town hall meetings. And that's the time one should go down and connect.
Let's move back to the Patriot Act, if we can. How was it that that legislation was adopted so quickly by the end of October of 2001 and having been introduced in mid-September?
Well, we had 9/11, 11th right. of September.
So was it in, was its adoption in reaction to the fright of 9/11, or do you feel that that document was prepared and waiting for the right moment?
Oh, I think that the philosophies had been prepared for a long time. The ability to implement those philosophies was not there until 9/11. It never would have been adopted had it not been for 9/11.
How did you vote on that?
I voted against it. And a lot of my colleagues who I have great respect for, who are legal scholars, which I'm not, ended up voting for it. They told me that, you know, on these votes, Barry, it's what people don't understand is when we go to vote, it's sort of in a toss of the coin. Is this bill 51% evil or 51% good? Because in this town, you mix it up and you don't get a, you know, bills that are non-controversial, we don't even vote on. They're just voted by a pass vote, a voice vote. So when a vote is recorded, except for some renaming of post offices and everything, which is a procedural way of getting us to the floor and getting us back into town. But the controversial issues are indeed that controversial, and they're very tough. And this is one where, for a lot of my colleagues on the Democratic side of the aisle, this was a close call, and they voted essentially in support of the act. I think they all regret it now. I happen to feel that the bill was rushed too quickly, that there was no public hearings on it, there was no oversight. There was a lot of danger in the bill, and we had, I figured it would be better to vote against it than to just take a leaping faith walk.
Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont, an independent, has introduced some legislation that he calls the Freedom to Read Act of 2003, of which you are a co-sponsor. Can you explain that to us?
Yes. In the Patriot Act, they required libraries and bookstores to, if the federal government requested, to give them a list of books that you've checked out, books that you've purchased, without ever telling you, the consumer. And the libraries have put up notices that this is a part of the law. Most libraries have said they will not comply with it, but nonetheless, it scares the hell out of everybody that the federal government can actually go in and snoop into your reading material.
What will the Sanders bill do then?
It would repeal that provision of the Patriot Act and not allow the government to do that kind of snooping.
Do you think it has any chance of passing and being signed?
I think it's got a chance, but it's going to be a thin one. It's not a great chance, but it's got an opportunity. This is one area when you get into government snooping that the left and the right both fear what the government may overstep its bounds and would like to put limitations on the government.
There's another area that concerns me, and that's the policy in the House and perhaps in the Senate as well, when an amendment can be attached to a bill that's unrelated to the underlying reason or the name of the bill and then get adopted right along. What's your opinion on that as a way to legislate?
Well, I think when I came here, I totally opposed it because in California, the Constitution prohibits multi-issue legislation. You can't do a fish and game code and a tax code and a welfare code and a water code on one bill in California. You could in Washington. I thought that was wrong because it kind of made it very confusing. Having been here now, I don't think we would get anything done unless you could attach those amendments. And the reason is very few bills, and this is really important to learn, very few bills get to the president. So all of these issues that are so important to the country, and there's a lot of good stuff, too, that gets into those bills. I'll give you an example that my predecessor in this job was Leon Panetta. He had worked for some time with local government creating a National Marine Sanctuary and carried the bill through a Democratic Congress But the bill couldn't get out on its own. It just wasn't, you know, important enough. So along came the bailout for the hurricane in Florida. I think it was Hurricane Mitch, and he just attached his bill to that as a writer, and it was, you know, the president was going to sign that bill. That was President Bush. So one of the things you're looking for is a bill that the president must sign, and a bill that will get to the president's desk. And when you see that opportunity, everybody tries to pile on.
But doesn't it then allow for the adoption of legislation in less than a full disclosure manner, less than a full hearing before a committee?
Well, we don't have those anyway, so it's there's nothing different about that than the underlying bill.
Well, Congressman Sam Farr, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I want to ask the question that you may have anticipated, since you know it. Can you tell us about something interesting you've read lately?
Oh, my gosh. I read so much, but as you know, and we've talked about it, it's so difficult to finish a book. Let me see. What have I read recently? I spent a lot of time last week. I happened to be at an Aspen Institute, which is a retreat, a think tank for members of Congress and some academic staff to really deal with an issue. We were dealing with global warming and things like that. We were in Rome, and I happened to go to the Borghese Gallery, which is one of the most incredible experiences of my life, and I picked up the book on that gallery and been reading about it. And it's, we think we know wealthy people in America, but you ought to see the way the families lived 300 or 400 years ago and what they were able to collect in way of art. And fortunately, it's still preserved and open to the public. So, but the ancient times far outdid the Bill Gateses of today.
Well, Congressman Sam Farr, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry.
Sam Farr is a member of the House of Representatives from Carmel, California. His district includes Monterey and Santa Cruz counties. Interesting reading material he has read lately are books about the Borghese Galleries in Rome, Italy. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your cards, letters, ideas, and suggestions for future programs. And here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and participate in our democracy. Join us again next week.